Chromosomes. Little strands of nucleic acids and proteins are the fundamental genetic instructions that tell us who we are at birth. Most people are born with 46 chromosomes, but each year in the United States, about 6,000 people are born with an extra chromosome, making them a person with Down syndrome. If you've ever encountered someone with Down syndrome, you know that they are some of the kindest, most joyful people you will ever meet. They truly have something extra. My name is Lisa Nichols, and for 30 years, I have been both the CEO of Technology Partners and the mother to Allie. Allie has something extra in every sense of the word. I have been blessed to be by her side as she impacts everyone she meets. Through these two important roles as CEO and mother to Allie, I have witnessed countless life lessons that have fundamentally changed the way I look at the world. While you may not have an extra chromosome, every leader has something extra that defines who you are. Join me as I explore the something extra in leaders from all walks of life and discover how that difference in each of them has made a difference in their companies, their families, their communities, and in themselves. If you like this episode today, please go to Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen and leave us a 5-star rating. Before we get started, I'm excited to share that my book, Something Extra, is now available. It is rooted in the remarkable spirit of our daughter, Allie, and the heartfelt conversations we've had on the podcast. You'll find wisdom and practical tools to ignite the leader within you and uncover your own Something Extra. Visit somethingextrabook.com or find it at Amazon or in all major bookstores to order your copy today. I'm excited to have Sam Goodwin on the show today. Sam is a national speaker and best-selling author. Well, Sam Goodwin, I am so excited. I've been so excited about this interview with you today, this podcast episode. Thank you so much for making the time to be on the show today. I am very grateful for you, and I cannot wait to introduce you to our listeners.
It's my pleasure. So happy to be here on Something Extra with you, Lisa.
And I have to give a shout out to our mutual friend, Laura Herring.
That's right.
Is the one that connected us. And I am so grateful. But now we've had some sidebar conversations, Sam, and we know a lot of the same people, which is really always fun, you know, to see that we've got lots more connections. But
absolutely. It's small world and getting smaller.
It is. And so there's just so much that I want to talk to you about. I told you also in a sidebar conversation where you've got a book called Saving Sam, and it's your story. And I told you on my trip to California to and from, I mean, I literally could not put it down. So I'm hoping that our listeners will go out and get the book and start following you. We're going to dig into that a lot more, but I would love for you to tell me, like, if you were to introduce yourself, and I mean, you've introduced yourself to people all over the world, and we're going to talk about that. How do you introduce yourself just beyond the headlines?
Oh, yeah, I guess it kind of depends on the setting, but I'm Sam Goodwin, originally from and grew up in St. Louis, Missouri, near the geographic center of the United States. Today I'm a speaker and author, and I live in DC now, but still love coming back to St. Louis where my parents are, and I'll always enjoy making it back there.
Yes, very much. And so that's a good segue, because I do want to talk to you about your family. And I know your family now. You grew up in a fairly large faith-filled family. You've got 4 siblings. I know a little bit about each of them now. Paul, David, Stephanie, and Betty. Is that right?
That's right. You were paying attention.
I was paying attention. So I know you just grew up. I mean, you guys, incredibly strong bonds between you all. You guys are like your siblings, your best friends. You and your brother played hockey together, just all kinds of stuff. But tell me, like, what values did your parents instill in you, Sam, that have still shaped how you live and work today?
Absolutely. I'm so grateful to my parents for instilling a strong Catholic faith into my 4 younger siblings and I, something that we've carried with us through our whole lives. And another thing I'll mention is today, so the 5 of us, we all live in different places. But what I found is actually that geographic separation, in my opinion, has actually made us closer in a way. And I think some of that is because it makes the time that we are together that much more special when you're really like, we really focus and put in the effort to make that time to be together. So in a way, it's like the geographic separation has actually made us like relationally closer.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah. I mean, I think about your family, and we're going to talk more about this, but it's kind of like all for one and one for all. I mean, you guys, and we're going to talk about the story, but your family was all in. And I think your family was really the secret sauce to what you went through and how you got out of what you went through. But, you know, I read that you love geography, even starting like at a young age. Your parents, I think, bought you a globe. Was it one of those talking globes, Sam?
You know, I don't know if it was one of the talking ones, and I'm not even sure like where that kind of curiosity, interest in geography, like really came from. But I do remember having that globe, and then in third grade, I won my class's geography B, which, you know, I was not very good in school. So for me to win anything academically was just really strange. But I had this kind of underlying curiosity from a young age around like the world and its people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, I love that you just said this lifelong curiosity about people around the world. And so that kind of, you know, led you into all kinds of adventures that we'll talk about. But I also know that you were a Division I hockey player. You went to Niagara University, right? What lessons, and I bet you there's a lot, what lessons did hockey teach you about teamwork and resilience and grit and discipline? I'm sure there's a lot.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, a career as a competitive athlete, I didn't even realize at the time the things that I was learning. But those skills and traits have helped me in so many ways beyond my playing career. The mental toughness, critical thinking, resilience, how many times that we had a boss or a coach tell us, control what you can control. I mean, we hear CEOs say all the time that they like to hire athletes. And I think that a lot of that is because of the skills and traits that are developed through those types of careers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know at one time, I don't know if this is still the case, but Enterprise Rent-A-Car, which you know is an iconic brand here in St. Louis, born in St. Louis, St. Louis made. I know at one time they always looked for, you know, people that had played competitive sports, you know, or Eagle Scouts, you know, was another thing that they would look for. And I think it's just those character traits that you learn that truly are transferable into the business world.
For sure. And sometimes those can be a little bit unteachable. So I think the idea is often bring someone who has those and then we can teach them the rest, right? So that like performance under pressure, teamwork, I think athletes have this unusual ability to deal with failure. And so all these things that just go into, you know, to our personal professional lives.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very good. Well, unfortunately, you suffered several concussions, I think, that are, you know, I'm sure you wanted to go on and play for the Blues.
That would have been great. It took a different path.
Yeah, it took you on a different path and a good path. I mean, you've got a great story. So, you know, but I mean, those you talked about dealing with failure. So how did that setback, I mean, how did you get through that setback? Because I'm sure that was disappointing for you.
For sure. So concussion injuries were something that I battled my entire career. It ended up kind of ending my formal playing career. And at the time, you know, my early 20s, kind of in my last couple of years of college, that was heartbreaking. It was as if the floor of my life was being ripped out from underneath me. I mean, I had never considered doing anything else other than playing hockey. That's all I wanted to do. And then that was essentially taken from me because the doctors told me that another, you know, head injury could do permanent damage to my brain. And you know, it just didn't make sense to continue, unfortunately. And so it was a challenging time. And you know, now with like, you know, hindsight and everything, I see that, you know, that led me down a path that, you know, has brought so many other opportunities and experiences. I didn't know that at the time. It was a lot younger. It was frustrating. It was really tough. You know, looking back on it, that's just kind of how it.
Yeah. Went. Yeah. You and I both know John O'Leary and John O'Leary's story, and Soul on Fire just came out. And, you know, he loved baseball. I'm sure John dreamed of being a Cardinals player, you know.
Sam, in the movie, I don't want to spoil it, but you know, when at one point somebody said, would you go back and do it differently? And at first he said, yes, I would. And then, you know, he realized that, wow, this has brought me on a path and meeting people and having experiences that I would not have had otherwise. So it doesn't mean it's not hard. Adversity is hard. And when we have those setbacks, it's hard and it's okay to grieve about it.
Absolutely. I would just say, I think we're all stronger and more resilient than we can imagine. And those uncertain times are exactly what we need in order to grow. And I'll also take this opportunity to just mention John. And I think he's just salt of the earth, incredible person. He's helped me so much over the past several years with kind of my business, and he's helped so many people. And he had me on his podcast. I mean, he's just been fantastic and can't say enough nice things about him. I'm so happy for his film that came out. I was telling you before this that I saw it last week and I left the theater just thinking, like, in my opinion, we need more movies like this. I mean, there's just so much like negativity and disagreements and all these things. Why don't we focus on the positives? Because there are so many positives. And I just, amen. I think we need more movies like that.
Yeah. Yeah. I could not agree more. And, you know, we hosted like a couple hundred people, you know, for the film, and the feedback that we got back, Sam, was just incredible. I mean, young people that came to the film and left, you know, saying, you know, one young woman said that, mom, that was a coming of age movie. And the mom said, what do you mean by that? She goes, I grew up in that movie. Yeah. You know, I mean, that is, you know, to affect positive transformation in people. Yes. I mean, stories like that certainly can do it. And I think your story is the same way, Sam. But, you know, you had this insatiable desire to travel. In fact, go ahead and tell our listeners, what was your mission?
So, right. So after college, kind of go back to the concussion thing, I wasn't sure what I was going to do. Long story short, I had the opportunity to go overseas to Singapore and work for a tech startup business. And actually originally only planned to be there for about 3 months. But I ended up staying for 6 years, and it was a fantastic opportunity, a great way to begin my professional career. I was working for this tech startup and an NGO. And throughout that time, I began to kind of travel as much as I could. I was in my early 20s in the heart of Southeast Asia, had, you know, a little bit of flexibility, my work schedule, had the world's best airport in my backyard, and it took advantage of that opportunity to explore as much of the region and beyond as possible. And just a personal preference when I traveled, I didn't like to repeat places. So even if I went somewhere and had a great experience, you know, the next week and the next holiday, the next opportunity I had, I would just go somewhere different. And so I put that formula into play for about 6 years. And in early 2018, I realized that I had traveled to about 120 countries in the world. And it was at that point when I remember thinking, well, like how many are there? I always travel because it was fun and I enjoyed it. But most importantly, I learned from it. Travel's the best education I've ever had. It was never about ticking boxes or checking places off a list. But I got to that point, I did a little bit of research and learned that there are 193 fully recognized UN sovereign states. And so I thought to myself, well, maybe I could go to all of them. And that competitive athlete in me likes setting goals and working toward achieving them and so on. So started doing some more research and decided to try and go to all the countries of the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And to your point, you know, Sam, when you went to these countries, you kind of immersed yourself a little bit, but you know, I love like talking about the people, and you know, you would experience the food, you would experience the culture. What were some of the most surprising things that you learned at some of the places that you visited?
Oh, I mean, travels in like generally taught me so much. I mean, it's taught me how to become comfortable being uncomfortable, about the power of perspective. It's taught me to never judge people by the actions of their government. I've learned that people who have the least often give the most. something that I found to be true in all corners of the world. More specifically, the one like just a story that comes to mind is I was in the Pacific Island nation of Samoa, and I had a friend of mine, a friend of a friend, who was showing me around. Her name was Marissa, and she took me around the island, had this great visit. And that evening we went to actually an Italian restaurant, and she brought actually her boyfriend with her to the dinner. So it was the three of us. And it turned out that her boyfriend, Paul, was one of the captains of the Samoan national rugby team. And, you know, in that part of the world, rugby's a big deal, right? But I didn't know quite how big of a deal it was until we went to pay our bill. And the currency in Samoa is called the tala. And Marissa, the waitress, comes over, and Marissa pulls out 10 tala to pay the waitress. And before she gives it to the waitress, she shows it to me. And Paul, along with the two other captains of the rugby team, are on the note. I looked at him and was like, you're on the money of this country. And so it was just this very surprise. Like, I think of people on money, it's like,
we put President
Washington or the Queen, right? Like Nelson Mandela, or in this case, it was Paul, the captain of the rugby team that was sitting. So just a kind of a surprising thing that happened, and these kind of quirky things happen in these kind of remote parts of the world sometimes.
Oh my goodness, that is funny. I'll remember that. You know, yeah, we put presidents on our money, you know, so that's really that's interesting. But that just shows you how much they value rugby, you know. So talk about this. You got to coach hockey in North Korea and maybe a few other places. How did those experiences, how did that all come about, and what did that teach you?
Yep. So in 2016, I was living in Singapore, and there was a Canadian man who was putting together this opportunity to go and coach and play against the North Korean national ice hockey team. And you know, I was already living in Asia, and I was playing some hockey there for fun, and so got connected with him and was immediately interested. And so, long story short, I spent a week there in March of 2016, and had a fantastic experience. I mean, we were treated like royalty. The food, the culture, everything was great. Now, I'm not oblivious to the fact that I saw what they wanted me to see, and getting off that tourist track, things can look different. But it was what it taught me, what was particularly memorable, was using hockey as a way to build a cultural bridge with people. And these guys on the team, they worked hard, they listened, they wanted to get better, they wanted to be there. And it was really a privilege to be able to share some, you know, some knowledge or some ideas with them. And so I think, you know, another thing that travel's taught me more broadly, and then also in this situation, is just we're all fundamentally the same. I mean, everywhere I went to every country in the world, and I found people just like us. We're all fundamentally the same. And the overwhelming majority of people in the world are well-intentioned, proud of their country, happy to help others. And it's unfortunate that there's often a small subset that gives a much larger group a bad kind of reputation, but most people are good. And that was even the case in North Korea.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Hockey, I love that, because you said, you know, hockey was the bridge, because these guys loved hockey, and it really, the other differences really kind of faded away.
Once that puck dropped, we didn't care about political discrepancies or demarcation lines or nuclear weapons. I mean, our relationship ran like a Swiss watch on the ice, and it was really a fantastic experience.
Beautiful. That's beautiful. Let's get into this a little bit, and then just in a couple minutes, we're going to take a quick break and we'll come right back. But by 2019, you had been to 180 countries, and you were closing in on your goal, 193 being the goal. Something drew you to Syria. I know that you met, and I can't remember her name. What was the really famous singer that you met?
Yeah, so in April, I I was in Fiji and I connected at the airport with Joss Stone, who's a British musician. And we had like, I kind of knew she was doing the same thing. She was also going to every country. So we kind of bonded over our, you know, similar journeys.
So, and I know that she had been to Syria and you said, you know, I'm going to go to Syria. She gave you some ideas of how, you know, to navigate. What can you just walk us through? And then we're going to take a quick break, but can you walk us through a little bit about what happened that day in Qamishli? Is that right? Qamishli?
Yep.
And everything changed that day for you.
Yeah. So, as you mentioned, this was May of 2019. I had been to 180 of 193 countries. And you know, for places like Syria or other kind of countries facing instability, there's always, you know, there's always a lot of different variables, things to consider when traveling there. And for me, on my entire journey, safety was always the top priority, like as much as it can be. And I still say that today. I mean, I don't think it's cool to be in unsafe situations. Like I don't go looking for trouble. At the same time, I was committed to completing my journey and really that curiosity from my third grade, you know, geography B in the globe that my parents got me was really driving all of this. And so there was also a religious component to Syria as well. It's one of the cradle of civilization. It's mentioned more than 300 times in the Bible. Mary Magdalene was of Syrian descent. Paul the Apostle's conversion took place on the road to Damascus. And so my faith was a big part of my travel journey. I'm Catholic. I've been to Mass in 65 countries. I've visited Catholic churches in 115. Anyways, there's so much instability happening in Syria, one of the most tragic humanitarian disasters of our lifetime. At the same time, it's one of the most culturally, historically, religiously significant places in the world. So I was really excited about that opportunity. But on May 25th, 2019, and I'm kind of, you know, moving through some of these details. A lot of this is in the book, as you can imagine. I was walking through a roundabout on the way to meet up with my guide. This was 2 hours after arriving in the country, when all of a sudden a black pickup truck abruptly pulled up next to me. Two armed men jumped out of the back seat and instructed me to get inside. And thankfully they weren't violent, but I didn't have a choice. I was scared, confused. I had no information or anyone to help. I was desperately trying to understand what was happening. And these men were loyal to the then Syrian president, Bashar al-Assad, and told me that they were skeptical about my travel history and my travel motives. And as we sped down back alleys of the city, the officers in the vehicle, they accused me of espionage, of being an American spy and collaborating with terrorists. And nothing like this had ever happened to me before.
Yeah. Gosh. I mean, Sam, and they didn't speak good English, right? I mean, So you're trying to figure out even what people were saying to you. So, I mean, it's just really not knowing the language. Let's take a break there.
Yep.
And then we'll come back and I've got lots of questions that we'll dig into, but let's take a quick break and we'll be right back on the Something Extra podcast with Sam Goodwin.
In business, the tendency is to seek out partners who are bigger, faster, stronger. When it comes to IT, you should be looking for smarter, faster, better. That's just what you'll find with the talented technologists at Technology Partners. Our experts develop custom solutions to tackle your most complex challenges, all to simplify your processes in the smartest, most efficient way possible. The time to be swift and nimble starts now. Go to technologypartners.net/solutions and see what's possible.
Welcome back, everyone, to the Something Extra podcast with Sam Goodwin. So we just left off where Sam was walking through a roundabout in Syria and a black pickup truck pulls up and he's commanded to get into the back of the pickup truck. And, you know, so, I mean, lots of things had to be going through your mind. You're probably just in a state of confusion, right, Sam? But when, you know, some people might say, why take a risk like that? How do you answer that now with the benefit of hindsight? Mm-hmm. How do you answer that question?
So yeah, I'll say I was scared, confused. I had no information or anyone to help. I was desperately trying to understand what was happening. So take a risk. Do you mean like traveling every country or going to like unstable places?
Unstable places. Yes. Yeah. They may have been like, that might've been one that I would have left off my, you know, but how do you, because listen, there's some silver linings that really came out of this whole experience. And we'll talk about that. A release of another person, you know, so,
how do you answer that? Talk about that one, but
yes.
So as far as taking risks in general, in 2023, I was invited to Niagara University, my alma mater, to be their commencement speaker. And I gave the students five key points. And one of them was to take risks. And so I think about it. I mean, a very quick story. When I, going back to this point where I had concussions and wanted to go to Singapore or had this opportunity, I wasn't sure whether that made sense. I just didn't know. And it seemed a little crazy. I mean, I was 23 years old. Shouldn't I be finally kind of being a little bit more responsible and all that stuff? And kind of related to this, I remember discussing this with my parents and I said, you know, I don't know what I should do. And my dad said to me, he said, Sam, if you go to Singapore and things don't work, the worst thing that happens is you just come home. And that kind of safety net, so to speak, was kind of like the foundation of my adulthood and really encouraged me to take risks. And then I went to Singapore and worked for a startup company and with so much uncertainty. I mean, startups are, right? And I remember I got there and for 6 years working for that company, you know, I'm in my early 20s, like 6 years, every meeting that I went into, I was the dumbest person in the room. And that was uncomfortable, but simultaneously this time of huge personal and professional growth. And so many of the things that, you know, I've enjoyed, the experiences that I've had have been as a result of taking risks and being uncomfortable. And so with the travel journey, generally speaking, I mean, at the time there were only about 100 people in history when I finished who had been to every country in the world. Now there's a few more. It's a pretty small group. And, you know, that doesn't happen without taking risks and having those experiences. So generally speaking, it was kind of just this curiosity and wanting to learn. At the same time, as I was mentioning a minute ago, like, that was always a balance with prioritizing safety and everything that was happening in different places. So it was all just kind of this constant balance.
Right. Well, I mean, Sam, I think of the old adage, we've all heard it, no risk, no reward.
Yeah.
Right? No risk, no reward. Yeah. And I know for me, you know, now here's what I say now, you do have to protect your yes. You have to protect your yes. So you have to, because like the busier you get, you know, everything comes at an expense of something else, right? Your yes comes at an expense of something else that you could be doing. But I know for myself, so many of the things that have been good in my life have because I said yes.
100%. So, and I like to use the metaphor with the turtle. So a turtle only moves forward when it sticks its neck out.
Mm-hmm. That's good. I like that. I love that. Well, let's talk about this. You spent 63 days, I think, 9 weeks in prison. The first month, and I just cannot, I'm reading this part, Sam, and I can't even imagine, especially you're a very social person. You get energy from people. And you spent the first month in Branch 215 in solitary confinement.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I spent 27 days in solitary confinement. The only human interaction I had was for a few seconds in the morning and evening when the guards brought bread and boiled potatoes and water. I found strength in that situation in kind of a range of ways from leaning in, like I leaned in to the perspective that I developed from traveling to different corners of the world, which provoked gratitude for just the basic food and water I was being given. I leaned on, as we were talking earlier, these skills and traits from being a competitive athlete. I leaned on this belief that I had a purpose in life and a desire to see family and friends again. And most importantly, you know, I leaned on my faith and prayer and the strength that came from that. It was interesting to like surrender to God while already being held captive. And so there were a lot of different things in place, but solitary confinement is torture. I mean, it's a cruel captivity tactic that's been used by people for centuries. So it's torture, and I wouldn't wish it on anybody.
Yeah. Well, a couple of things. You probably felt a little like Paul. You felt a little like Paul in prison, right? You know, but free in Christ, you know, even though he was captive.
Yeah, well, from a spiritual standpoint, sometimes I felt like maybe God was using prison to bring me closer to him, as he did with Paul. And
absolutely.
At that point, I often thought, well, like, you know, maybe could you like choose a different method?
But I'm sure Paul thought that a few times too, yeah. But really and truly, it was like everything that you would normally have been dependent on, like your strong family ties, mm-hmm. Friends, things like that, were stripped away and you had God. But here's what I thought was really interesting. I mean, I think you really, your mindset, Sam, to get through that, you know, because you said, like, I remember you saying, like, you had a daily routine. I mean, you set yourself up a daily routine. Now, what was really difficult is there were no windows. So you didn't know if it was morning or night, or, you know, you kind of came up with your own, I guess, methodology to figure out if this is morning or night, and based on like the meals and things like that. But yeah, I remember you saying you ran around, you know, you would run around the cell 25 times one direction and then turn around and go the other direction.
That's right. And something I'll mention on that is about 6 months after I came home, I was invited to North Carolina by the US SEER team. So Survival, Evasion, Resistance, and Escape. And these are members of our military who are put on missions where they're at risk of being captured. And I gave a presentation to 75 Green Berets and SEER team instructors. And what they wanted to know was basically this exact thing that you just mentioned, like what did I do in that situation without any training? And it turned out that some of the things I instinctively did were what they teach in their program. And one of those was establishing a routine. And it makes sense, because I just think about how much more productive we are in our life, in our personal, professional lives, when we have a routine.
Yes.
When we have that process structure. In place, that mm-hmm. structure. And so the same was actually the case in, you know, a very tough situation in solitary confinement. And so I would do all these different things to pass time. And I had time in the day for all of them. I would pretend the cell was full of people and tell stories. I would sing songs. I would remember hockey games that I played in my life from start to finish. I had time to eat. I had time to pray. I had time to exercise, like you were saying, walking the laps, and all of that became so important for that routine, which was just like crucial for emotional and psychological health.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But to your point, I mean, really we're better when we've got a routine and we've got discipline in our life. Right. So yeah. Yeah. You had this, I said prayer became an uninterrupted conversation with God. And I love that. I love that. You would use the rosary, you know, with using your fingers as the beads. I love this. You said, I was working to forgive people who weren't even sorry. They weren't even sorry. How did you reach that level of forgiveness, Sam? Because that's hard. I mean, let's make no bones about it. It's hard to forgive people that have hurt you.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, yeah, some of my prayers, you mentioned there were, it was kind of this string of prayers, but I prayed very hard for the courage to forgive these captors. And what I realized was, as you mentioned, I was working to forgive people who they weren't even sorry. And that's strength. I mean, forgiveness I found is not a feeling, it's a choice. And mm-hmm. that's what I discovered in that situation. And for me, and someone can probably articulate this better, but what I imagined was I was going to do everything I could to forgive these people. And I was going to address kind of that bond or that kind of link between us, but then they still have to answer to God later, and they can deal with that. But I'm going to do my part here as best I can. Mm-hmm. And I have to say, I'm also like speaking like kind of like, I like, it wasn't this, I maybe making it sound easier now than it was at the time. Cause it was, you know, this, I'm like 6 years out, you know, I speak about this story for a living. And like, sometimes I feel like I'm maybe not, you know, communicating how challenging it was.
How difficult it was.
So like, there may be a little bit of that, but basically that was kind of how I imagined the forgiveness side of it. And there came with that quite a bit of peace, actually. It was hard to get there, but after I got to some level of forgiveness, there was some peace because I could just put that aside. I've addressed that. Now yeah. I can, you know, work on addressing other things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And not, listen, if there's listeners out there that, you know, are struggling with this, it's not easy. It's not easy, but unforgiveness will keep you in bondage.
Unforgiveness was just more captivity.
Mm-hmm. Right. Exactly. It's kind of an oxymoron, but so true. Well, let me ask you this. Let's talk about your family and your family. Oh, my goodness. I absolutely fell in love with your family, Sam, because your family was trying to move mountains.
Yeah.
To bring you home.
Yeah. So one of the most overwhelming things for me when I was released was learning about everything that happened on the outside while I was trapped on the inside. And it was also challenging for my family to learn about the details of me on the inside. And actually I was on USA Today last week talking about the hostages being released in Gaza and giving them some advice. And one of the things that I mentioned was this point, like, because the people on the outside don't know the details about the inside and vice versa. And that can be, so when someone's released, there's all these different emotions. Like, there's incredible happiness, there's excitement, but there's also like, it's disorienting and there's confusion. And so there's this whole like reintegration process that happens, but it can be pretty heavy for family members to learn about everything that happened. And so in my case, it was overwhelming. I mean, it's 6 years later today, Lisa, and I'm still saying thank you to people. I'm still mm-hmm. learning about someone who made a phone call or said a prayer or talked to a friend, whatever it might be. And so when I went to write the book, what I realized was that half the story wasn't even mine to tell. It was really my family's. And as I learned more about what they did, there were times where I would be learning these things about what they went through and think, gosh, in some ways I feel like I had the easy part. Like, mm-hmm. I don't know if it was better or worse to be on the inside or outside, because for every hostage or wrongful detainee around the world, there's also a family that's going through the hardest thing that they've ever gone through
right.
in their life, something nothing can prepare them for. Mm-hmm. And so anyways, I learned about it all in the aftermath, and that's why the book is kind of told. There's it's like two stories. There's
from different perspectives, right? Your mom's perspective, your dad's perspective, Stephanie's perspective. Right. Yeah, and I love that because it's so true. I mean, they were going through their own, their own hell, if you will. Yeah. You know, absolutely. Thinking about their son, thinking about their brother. Mm-hmm. You know, your mom. You know, she, I mean, I know she's a prayer warrior. But let's talk about this, because ultimately, obviously, your parents had the FBI involved. They had all kinds of folks involved, although they kept it very close, you know, so they would not get out publicly, because there could have been risk in that. But ultimately, Sam, incredible, Stephanie, your sister that lives in Nashville, remembered a classmate. I mean, that was kind of the, I think that was kind of the breakthrough moment, really. You know, can you just talk about that a little bit? How did you, it's not a series, I say, I don't believe it was a series of coincidences. I think it was, you know, God putting that in her heart, you know, to call her roommate to say, hey.
Yeah, absolutely. So for me, there's only one explanation that makes any sense. I mean, I believe that God intervened here, and you know, it was meant to survive. And so, miraculously, and I mean that word when I say it, it was my family who found this route. So, in a nutshell, my family was working with all of these different agencies: the FBI, the CIA, the White House, the Pentagon. Pope Francis was involved, Russian intelligence, Middle East NGOs, private sector security companies, the list goes on. And the U.S. government, incredible people, worked very close with my family. It was a tough situation from just a geopolitical situation. It's not their fault. It was just, there's no diplomatic or economic ties between Washington and Damascus. So it made it complex. And so my sister Stephanie ended up talking to her former college roommate, who is coincidentally also named Stephanie. And it turns out that she is Lebanese, and her uncle is good friends with the head of Lebanon's internal security, which is kind of like the equivalent of the FBI here in the US. And he was able to go to his counterpart in Damascus and mediate my release when so many others were struggling to do anything. And so, you know, we were talking earlier about the world being small and 6 degrees of separation and all of that. So, you know, all very connected, but it just, it puts a lot into perspective, and just so grateful, of course. But that was, you know, when it was funny when I was released, and I got into the office in Lebanon, my parents were there, and they had brought Joseph, who was Stephanie's uncle. And I remember my mom said to me, she was like, "Sam, do you remember Stephanie's roommate from college?" And this is like 10 minutes after I've been released. And I said to her, I said two things. I was like, one, no, I don't. I mean, I had been living in Asia at the time. Like, I didn't know my sister's college roommate. Like, it was just, you know. So one, I said, no, I don't. And my second point was, and why are we talking about that?
Isn't that a strange question?
Yeah, like why is that being discussed right now? And so I just couldn't even like have imagined what had happened.
Yeah. Yeah. So amazing. Your mom attended mass on the feast of Saint, is it Charbel?
Charbel. Yeah.
Charbel, just hours before your release. You know, and I did not realize this, but I looked it up, and Saint Charbel is the saint of miracles.
Okay. So just a very quick story on that. And again, I learned about all of this. So my family's working with all these different people, and then Stephanie's, you know, they have this phone call. And so the Lebanese path, it's looking like that's kind of the most promising lead. And I was released on July 26th. So on the 24th, my mom and my sister Betty went to a daily mass at, for any of the St. Louis listeners, it was at St. Mary Magdalene in Brentwood. And at the time, Monsignor Ramakati, who is actually now at the school that I went to in grade school, St. Clement, but he was at St. Mary Magdalene. And my mom and Betty go to this mass. And during the homily, Monsignor Ramakati says, today is the feast of St. Charbel. And my mom and Betty, they kind of admit, they looked at each other and say, well, like, we've actually, like, I don't know, I've never heard of St. Charbel. And so he goes on and tells a story. He's a 19th century Lebanese monk. He was a hermit, well known for working miracles and all stuff. And as the story goes, at the end of the homily, Monsignor Ramakati says, he kind of like makes a joke, essentially. He's like, so if anybody here needs a miracle in Lebanon, pray to Saint Charbel. And my, you know, Betty and my mom look at each other and like, oh my gosh, this is crazy. They leave. And 3 hours later, my parents get a message from Joseph, Stephanie Hajar's uncle, saying that my release had been granted.
Yeah.
Through the Lebanese.
Makes me just teary-eyed. Yeah. It makes me just teary-eyed, Sam.
Yeah.
It's really amazing. You, I'm sure it was just amazing being reunited with your mom and dad, you know, in Beirut and that. I think you even, did you guys go visit, did you and your mom go visit the tomb of Saint Charbel? I think you did.
So right? That evening after it was released, we went to Saint Charbel Monastery just outside of Beirut and we prayed together there. And
it's amazing. Amazing. Okay. So I've got more, but we're running out of time here. So
sorry, I was talking
to you this question. No. I love it. We could go on for hours and hours, but neither of us have that kind of time. And we don't want to do that to our listeners. I want the listeners to go buy your book, right? Or go hear you speak somewhere. But this was cool. This is about that silver lining that I talked about. There's a story about this 44-year-old man, that had been captive as well and imprisoned. I can't remember. I think he'd been in prison for at least a couple of years. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about your family and how you guys, God used you guys as an instrument to help him get released, which was a miracle.
Lisa, you would get along very well with my mother. I can tell you that. But quick story on that. This was about 2 days after I came home. My father got a phone call from a Canadian woman who said that she had seen the news of my release, so forth, and explained that her son, his name was Christian Baxter, he had been missing in Syria it was actually about 9 months at the time. Okay. And she was saying that she was working with like the Canadian government and a little bit, but like she didn't really have a lot of kind of ideas or just ways. She was really just kind of praying and just, you know, hoping that her son would come home. So, my dad kind of gathers some information and then we send it to General Ibrahim in Lebanon. And, exactly 2 weeks later after my release, Christian was released through the intervention of Abbas Ibrahim in Lebanon. And so, in a way that connection between my sister and her roommate really led to the release of two people who were wrongfully detained. And so my mother often says that she believes that the entire reason that this happened to me was to answer the prayers of Christian's mother.
Yes. Who was a single mom.
He was
her only son. I mean, you know, he was her life. I mean,
exactly.
I just think the same thing, Sam, because she did not have the connection. She didn't have the, even maybe the critical thinking, you know, right, that your family had.
My dad had put together an entire team and was working on every day and like that, yes. Didn't have those
reasons. Yeah. So cool. Oh my goodness. Well, it's just amazing. I've so many different questions still that I have here, but your book is Saving Sam. Listeners, go get the book. You won't be able to put it down. It truly is a testament to faith, family, and resilience. And, yeah, I love it. And Sam is now a keynote speaker. So if you need a keynote speaker for an event, you know, reach out to him and we'll put all that in the show notes. I know now that you've gone on to get a master's in international affairs. You got that from WashU. Did you just finish your doctorate too from Johns Hopkins?
About a year and a half ago. So I finished that, which was I enjoyed that as well.
I love it. Well, Sam, this is called Something Extra. What do you believe is the something extra? And I'll give you a couple if you need that every great leader needs.
So something that comes to mind with that is to, in addition to everything that we have going on in our professional lives, something extra that we can do is to continue to grow outside of our work as well. So over the past few years, you know, as you mentioned, I continued to go to school. Like I went to WashU, I did a doctorate at Johns Hopkins. In the past year, I got my pilot license. It was something that I worked on really hard for a year. Now I'm training for an Ironman. So it's something kind of outside of my kind of traditional work that I'm working on. So I think that we continue to kind of grow and evolve and push ourselves. You know, I think the more that we take on challenges on our own terms, the better we are when they come at us when we're not expecting them. I think the more that we sweat in peace, the less we bleed in war. And so I encourage people to do something extra and push themselves kind of outside of their professional life.
That's so good. Those are the operative words, taking on challenges on your own terms.
Right? Exactly.
Not something that's forced on you from somebody else.
Yeah.
That is so good. Well, Sam, I have absolutely loved getting to know you. I'm so excited now for our listeners to hear your story. And it's going to be fun to sit back and watch what happens with Sam Goodwin, because there's going to be some really good stuff in the future, and you're going to continue to be used, I know, to make the world a better place.
Thank you so much, Lisa, for helping to spread the word. Congratulations on all of your success.
Thank you for listening to today's show. Something Extra with Lisa Nichols is a Technology Partners production. Copyright Technology Partners, Inc., 2019. For show notes or to reach Lisa, visit tpi.co/podcast. Don't forget to leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or wherever you listen.